Welcome to the Gifters Podcast. I'm your host, Christopher Kai. This podcast is sponsored by the GPS Online Program, which teaches you how to turn your story into a successful speaking and online coaching business. For more information, go to ChristopherKai.com. Our guest today is Becky Morrison. She's an executive coach, former lawyer, and the founder of the Butterfly Society. Becky, welcome to our show today.
Thank you, Christopher. I really appreciate the opportunity to be here and chat with you.
I just love the fact that my role in this show is to read about people, learn about people, and then share their stories with the world. And when I read your story, I mean, perhaps since you're a lawyer or a former lawyer, my brother's a lawyer, I have a lot of friends that are lawyers. So already from a filial piety standpoint, I said to you prior to this show, I'm like, man, I don't know, Becky, if you realize how great of a skill set you have as a lawyer. You're like, what do you mean? I'm like, well, every single entrepreneur, business owner, executive can utilize your skill sets because you oftentimes have a very analytical mind, you know? And I'm curious, when you look back at your childhood, were there moments that you started defining who you were or started understanding that you might have had some of these gifts in yourself as this self-aware person?
I mean, I'll be really honest with you. It took me a minute to figure it out. And I think we were talking about this earlier, but I landed in law because it's what I thought I should do. And let me tell you where that story starts, if that's okay.
Yeah, sure.
So it starts with my parents. I'm an only child. I was raised by parents. My father was a Lutheran pastor and my mom was a lawyer for a really large corporation for the bulk of her career. And as she moved up the ladder at that corporation, she was given the opportunity to get some leadership development support and training back when leadership development was like the new thing, right? I mean, it was like cutting edge. And so she went through this year-long leadership development program and probably about halfway through, came home one night. And at that point I was in middle school. So I'm going to say about 12 years old and called a family meeting over dinner, which was unusual. That was not the kind of thing that we did very often. And sat down and said, you know, I have something to tell you guys. I'm kind of uncomfortable and worried about how you're going to react, but I want to let you know that as part of my homework for my leadership development program, I need to share with you that my career is my top priority. And so here I am sitting there, a 12-year-old, and my initial response in 1980, whatever it was duh. I mean, she had literally been living like work was her top priority, but for her to claim it took a lot. And I want to be clear and add that I in no way felt less loved, right? It was possible very much. I mean, I had great parents who created a very wonderful, safe environment for me to grow up in. But it was really important for me to hear that she was claiming what mattered most to her. And frankly, it was a relief because it allowed me and my father, who both cared deeply about her, to help invest in her achievement of what mattered. And so that moment really was defining for me because I realized the power of claiming your priorities. Now, took me several decades after that moment to understand that as her daughter, I didn't need to share the same priorities and that it was about really finding my own way. So,
well, let's focus on that moment for now, because I mean, 12 years old, that's very impressionable. I mean, I used to teach high school. I've taught junior high as well. And that's one of those ages where you can go this way or that way. And that's something that you took it well, but I'm curious, I mean, did you always already know that you were loved? So even though your mom said that, because you could have either said, wait, mom, I'm not your priority. What do you mean? I mean, I'm curious, like, how did that happen? I mean, did you already have that self-awareness that you were loved? So it wasn't that what you call a big deal?
I think there's two things that went into it. Yeah. First, I very much knew I was loved. There was never any question of my value as their child. But I think the second thing is that my parents placed a pretty high premium on independence and on figuring stuff out for myself. And so I think I already was pretty independent by that point. I didn't need a whole lot of parental supervision. I mean, when I say a high priority, I mean, I was really encouraged to try to figure things out on my own first. And so, yeah, I mean, I think by 12, I was already doing my own laundry because I was frustrated at how my dad had done it. I was probably managing most of my own homework because again, it was just, that was the expectation. And so what I was missing out on, quote unquote, missing out on by having my mom's top priority be work wasn't much, you know, it wasn't a change. She already was working a lot. Her career was very important. My dad was the one who was more present at home and that was working just fine. And so it wasn't as though she was saying, I'm suddenly going to invest more time. It was just clear. It was clear when the choice had to be made between X and Y, I'm going to choose career. And that just to me was a, I don't want to say a relief because it makes it sound like there was a lot of tension, but it was a relief. It was nice to know what mattered.
Yeah. No, but that's so powerful. I've literally never met anyone talk about this, having first a family meeting and then saying to their child, you're not, I mean, you're a priority, but that takes a lot of courage for your mother to have done that.
Because for sure.
It's one thing to coach someone to do something, but to do that, that's really telling. And again, I read somewhere, I'm not a parent, but I've worked with a lot of kids, and it's like, I always hear that it's not what you say, it's what you do. And your mother is modeling the behavior of someone who's courageous, who's mm-hmm. someone self-aware, and someone who follows through. And that's so fascinating and telling. So talk to us about from age 12 to, let's say, when you get into high school and college, when did you start forming this identity about who you were and what path you headed toward as a career professional?
So, I mean, like I said, it took me a long time to figure out what my path was. So high school to college, I mean, I went to what I consider a good college. I went to Wellesley. And then from Wellesley, I got a job, which I did for a couple of years, always knowing I was going to go to grad school. And then I went to law school because it seemed like the next logical step. And I'd love to have a story for you about wanting to be a lawyer to fight for the little guy or something like that. But it really wasn't that. It was, you know, this is what you do. You go get a career and then you move yourself up the ladder. And it really wasn't until I was probably 4 years into the practice of law.
What kind of law were you involved with?
So I was an antitrust litigator. So I worked for a large law firm and primarily defended companies who either wanted to merge or had merged and the merger was being challenged by a government agency. And so here I am a couple years into practice. I'm married at this point. My husband is working in counterterrorism. So super intense career. And we have a 2-year-old, or I guess she's a little less than 2 at this point. And it was one of those nights where I had a very full day scheduled and something blew up in the world. And we had an agreement, my husband and I. Literally something blew up in the world. And he was stuck at work. And we had an agreement that, you know, his mission took precedence over my mission. And so I was the one who then had to go and pick up our daughter at daycare. Well, we happened to be in very busy trial prep. And so I get home and I've got calls late into the night and I've got a 2-year-old or 18-month-old at that point that I'm trying to manage. And I can distinctly remember this moment where I'm on the phone with the expert with the cordless phone clipped to the back of my pants, the notebook resting on the toilet seat cover and my daughter in the bathtub. And so I'm trying to manage bathing my daughter and running this meeting and taking notes that I'm then gonna have to type up for the team the next day. And I can remember this thought of, man, I am literally doing it all. Like, this is it. I'm the epitome of the working mom. Like, look at me killing it, right? And then within not even a breath, the thought was, this is not sustainable. I'm not happy. Something needs to change. And that was really the moment where I started to think about, what are my priorities? Not what do I think they should be? Not what were my mom's priorities? What does Becky want to be for the rest of her life? What matters to her success and to her happiness? And how do we architect a life around that? And so that was the beginning of stepping into this path that I'm on now.
Wow. Again, that sense of self-clarity and self-awareness. So you go from having that awareness, and then from the moment that you say, okay, I'm done with law, because so many of us, so many people around the world, I mean, when I worked at American Express, I said, you know, I'm going to give it a few years. But by that point, I was already beginning to write a book. But when I was 26 at the time, I'm at American Express on Wall Street, I would literally say to myself, if I'm here at 30, I'm going to like shoot myself. Not literally, but just like, I cannot fathom going back to forward motion thinking or forward thinking hindsight, I call, where I don't want to be here. I mean, it's like, I had my luxury apartment I bought, I'm building up my stock portfolio, I have this great job at this very prestigious company on Wall Street, but I'm like, yeah, this is not where I see myself. So I was not the most patient person. So I left after 2 years at American Express. And then flew out to California, wrote my first book, and that has begun my journey over the last 20 years. So for you, what were some of those turning points and those moving forward so that our listeners and our viewers can really learn from your example, Becky?
Yeah. So I would love to say that I was as brave as you were, but I wasn't.
I
So
don't
I
know if I
had
was
that,
brave, I was just like a lot of
well,
fear and pain.
brave or impatient, whatever, the result is the same, right? And I would say this. So, you know, I had that moment, that bathtub moment that I just described with my daughter. And then it took me another 18 months to decide that it was time to make a job change. And I did what most people do when they are unhappy in their job. They don't quit and go to California and write a book, right? They look for the next logical job that would fit them, that might be different. And so the first thing I did was look at other firms, thinking maybe the balance of life will be different at other firms. Maybe I will like law more at another firm. And very quickly realized that no, that was not actually considering what my priorities were. My top priority was to be an available parent. I still wanted to work outside the home, but I wanted the flexibility to be able to show up at, you know, the preschool Christmas program or the after-school sports event. And so I did take a turn off of that path of lawyerdom, but I didn't take a radical turn. I went and worked for another large litigation firm in DC on the admin side. And what that got me was the ability to keep my feet wet in the law, but to have way more control over my schedule and to declare, hey, my top priority is momming or being available to my family. And so if you know, if the kid is sick, I'll be home. If I want to go to an after school event, I'll take the leave to do it. And so I spent about a decade in that space before realizing that, and now by that point, I have two kids and they've grown up a little bit. And then I started to realize that, okay, that was great for that chapter. But now my happiness is starting to flag again. I'm feeling a little bored. What next? And so took another jump. This one was a bigger, a little more risky jump, kind of outside of the law into the world of finance, working for sort of a small entrepreneurial finance organization, and got my taste of what it meant to be in an entrepreneurial environment. And I was like, this is different, right? And this goes back to I came from a world where my mom was in corporate and I thought that's what success looked like. I hadn't even considered that there might be this world, this bigger world. And so it's been a series over several decades of breaking down sort of the blinders around the edges of what the possibilities are and really being able to engage in a wide-ranging look at what makes me tick, what makes me happy, and what's possible. And so a couple of years ago, I had a moment where I had again to sort of look at what was going on and what did I want to do. And that's where I really took all of the barriers down and said, what if I could do anything, what would that be? And the answer was help people. Spread joy, help people, serve. And so that's where I really dove kind of headfirst into coaching and working with people to help them on this same journey that I've been on over the course of my life.
That's great. And this Butterfly Society, talk to us about that. Is that the company that you created to help other people?
So that is one piece of what I do. And the Butterfly Society is really about creating a space and and it's still evolving, but a space for connection and for growth and for support, both from a coaching perspective, but then also like the goal long term is to create true community for people as they're walking this path of figuring out who they want to emerge into being.
You know, what's fascinating, Becky, is I was preparing a presentation last year and I was looking back at this online program I have called GPS, where I help professionals become speakers and online coaches. And as I was piecing together, because it's all about how can I serve, how can I help? And sometimes when you're constantly working, 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 you forget the people you impact. And as I was looking through the Facebook friends of my clients, I was like, whoa, like they all know each other. And then I would ask them, like, how do you know this person? I'm like, Chris, you introduced us. We're part of your pro. And
That's funny.
I forgot, like, wow, Shahzad in Sweden met Ernest in Miami, and they're like hanging out somewhere in Europe. And it just reminded me that business isn't just about business, it's about community.
Yep.
And community isn't just physical, it's online now. So when you
Yes.
talk about this butterfly society, it's so telling because it's all about that community and this butterfly effect. So why did you choose that butterfly name?
You know, I mean, I've always liked sort of what butterflies stand for in terms of evolution, metamorphosis, growth, beauty, all of that. But actually, the name came up just as I was in this last transition. I had a good friend whose daughter was headed off to college, and she was feeling the pangs of sending her first off into the world. And we were texting back and forth, and I wrote back, I said, this is just her butterfly season. Like, this is a chance for her to emerge. And then I sort of was thinking about that and I started to get a little bummed. I'm like, wait a minute, your butterfly season is when you're 18? Like, what are we doing with the rest of our lives? And I was like, no. There's many, many butterfly seasons. Like anytime that you're in this place in your life where you, a new part of you is emerging, that's your butterfly season. And so that's where that sort of symbolism, that symbology was born with the work I'm doing now.
And Becky, the way that you share that, because I just told you, one of my mentors, he just turned 77 and he introduced me to Richard Solomon, the founder of TED, and he's 85. But what inspires me about both of them, some people might think, oh, I'm going to retire when I'm 60. I'm like, no, these two people, one, my mentor is like in, I don't even know where he is. He's like flying somewhere. And Richard, he's like creating his own gallery or have a show because now he's sculpting and painting. But when you shared that with me, it reminds me that we do have various butterfly seasons, and that's great. Now let's dive into your coaching work, because you shared about your law experience, your parents, and with your husband, like literally a bomb went off. It's kind of crazy and scary, but also I admire his service to our country. But talk to us about that. So you say you want to help people. Mm-hmm. Now, how do you go about helping people, and who do you help? So who are your main types of clients that you like working with?
So there's two kind of categories of clients that I'm really focused on right now. And one I call emerging leaders. And what I mean by that actually is leaders who are emerging to a new level of leadership. So somebody who is at a new place on the ladder. Typically, I talk in corporate terms, C-suite or C-suite bound. In law firm terms, it's maybe like on the edge of partnership or about to be a partner. And I work with them to look at their leadership skills, their leadership blind spots, and really help them step into what will be their next level authentic leadership. So that's one category. Then I have a group of people that I work with who fall more in the entrepreneurial space. And so it's entrepreneurs who want to grow. And that's really vague sounding, but let me put a little more structure around that. So maybe their business is at a point where they want to grow their business, and they're struggling with issues around leadership, around delegation, around structure, around focus, around clarity, that kind of stuff. And, or it may just be that they're at a crossroads themselves. Coaching a couple people who are running small businesses and querying, is this enough? Is this all I want to do? What do I want to do next? What's the next butterfly season for me? And what is that going to look like? And so working in that vertical has been a lot of fun too. And then I have a book coming out that I think will have even wider reach. It's called The Happiness Recipe, A Powerful Guide to Living What Matters. And it's really based on the journey of my life, plus my experience coaching people kind of through this process of figuring out what drives their happiness, what they're here to do, and how to make that a part of their life today, not a part of their life someday.
You know, Becky, I know you say you're a formerly trained lawyer, but you have really good marketing prowess, given the whole butterfly. Oh, I'm excited. And the happiness, because all these terms, because when people ask me about branding, you want to smile when you hear about branding. It's not just this corporate-y language. So the whole happiness recipe, let's talk about that, because I'm literally salivating. You go from butterfly seasons to now, okay, am I going to have my vegan dinner or going for that medium rare, you know, steak?
Yeah. Yeah.
So talk about this happiness recipe.
So the happiness recipe, I mean, the premise is pretty simple. The premise is that, well, a couple things. First, that we all deserve to be happy, and that we all deserve to be as happy as possible right now, right? That we shouldn't be postponing that happiness. And that in order to be as happy as possible right now, what we need to do is do more of what matters and less of the rest. Super easy, right? No, not at all easy. First, we have to be clear on what matters. We have to be able to know and tell other people that this is my priority, kind of like what my mom did when I was 12. We then need to be able to spend our time on what matters and less of our time on the rest. And there's a whole bunch that goes into being able to say no, being able to create that space. And then in the middle, we need to have the mindset and beliefs that support that evolution and that change and that move to doing more of what matters and less of the rest. And so the book is really an action-based guide, along with stories from my own life, stories from my clients, kind of walking people through accomplishing that for the season that they're in right now. And the idea would be that this is a structure and tools that you can use for each one of your butterfly seasons.
Yeah. Let's talk about that, Becky, in terms of saying no, because a lot of times we live in a world where it's all about FOMO, fear of missing out. I have a term called more FOM, which is focus on what matters most. It's exactly what you're saying.
That.
What matters most. So A lot of people might have difficulty saying no. So what do you encourage your clients to do when they have all these priorities, but it doesn't matter to who they genuinely are? What are some suggestions and strategies you encourage them to learn to say no more?
So, I mean, I think the first thing is to just recognize that we are literally not trained to say no. From a very early age, we are told that we don't say no, right? It's ironic because it's one of the first words that kids learn and like to use. And then we literally, not actually beat it out of them, but we literally beat it out of them, right? We're like, no, 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 we don't use that word, or you don't say that to me, right? So the first thing is just to acknowledge that there are years of programming that make saying no feel bad. The second thing is to acknowledge that because it feels bad doesn't mean it's wrong. Because it's uncomfortable and new doesn't mean it's something that you shouldn't do. So once we can get through those layers, then it becomes bringing a higher level of intentionality to looking at what you're saying yes to. We don't do that. So I'll just give you a really small tactical example. I have an exercise in my book, and one that I use with a lot of clients. I call it Subtract Sunday. And it got its name because I like to plan my week coming up on Sunday. And I know I'm not alone in that, right? That's a productivity tip that a lot of people have adopted. But what I see my clients doing and what I used to do is look at all the things that I thought I had to do. And then Sunday was spent putting the puzzle together without any consideration of whether the pieces in that puzzle were the right pieces. First step of Subtract Sunday. What on my upcoming to-do list and in my schedule is tied to what matters to me? That gets scheduled first. What's on there that is not tied to what matters to me? And can I subtract it?
You know, Becky, as you share that story, you remind me of Jeff Bezos. Some of us may have heard of him, where he has this framework called the regret minimization framework, where when he was in his early 30s, working at a hedge fund in New York City, he found out this stat that the web usage was growing at 2,300%. And he thought to himself, would I regret staying on Wall Street? He said, no, I'm not going to regret that. But if he said, will I regret not being part of this internet world? Now, mind you, this is in 1994. So now, oh yeah, it's so obvious. No, it's not. But at the time, he said to himself, would I regret not being on the internet? He's like, I would regret it. Mm-hmm. But going back to what you're saying, it's about making those self-aware decisions that he said no to a lucrative job, to certainty, to a pretty high life. Mm-hmm. And yet his wife at the time was grateful and smart and bold enough to say they're packing up everything, driving out to Seattle, and ultimately creating Amazon, which now 20 plus years later, he's like a billionaire, right? But
right.
He always talks about making quality decisions. Mm-hmm. It's not about thousands of decisions. It's about high quality. So mm-hmm. with you, it sounds like you are making these very high quality decisions. And how do you go about really not just saying, okay, you got to say no, but how do you actually keep them accountable to actually execute some of their goals?
Well, I mean, I think it comes down to, for goal execution, it's a couple things. It comes down to the why, right? Why does that goal matter to you? Is it tied into your priorities? And that's always going to be easier to execute. But I think more than that, it comes to, I mean, there are so many things, Christopher, that get in the way of us executing our goals that have nothing to do with our goals.
That's why they have you, Becky.
Yeah, no, that's but it's true. But so when you ask, that's why I'm struggling a little bit to answer this question, because when you ask about accountability, I'm like, well, accountability is last. Like, first we have to get through all of this stuff that stops us from executing our goals. You know, stuff that stops us from saying no, like, I believe I have to do more to have more. Mm. That is a mistaken belief. Yeah. You have to do more of what matters to have more of what matters. But the solution is not just doing more, because that's a recipe for burnout and unhappiness. And, you know, so getting past some of those like foundational shifts that you have to make, once you clear that out and you've got a clear priority and you're willing to own it, executing on it's the easy part. Accountability is the easy part. To me, it's the work that comes before that to get your nervous system on board and your brain on board. That's the hard part.
So that's a really interesting point, Becky, because ultimately you said it earlier before about programming. We're all programmed to think and act a certain way. Mm-hmm. I remember when I was a kid, 6 years old, I'd be riding my bike around my block in Woodside, Queens. I see my friend Charlie across the street. He's riding his bike. I'm like, hey, Charlie, how are you? Like, hey, Chris. Hey, come over here, Charlie. I want to talk to you. He's like, oh, sorry, Chris, I can't. My mom told me I can't cross the street. Mm-hmm. And that moment of not talking to strangers, not crossing the street, being afraid, the amygdala, fight or flight, and we're programmed. Now, granted, of course, our parents don't want us to cross the street and talk to strangers, but what you just said is so telling and important that all of us should remind ourselves that we're programmed a certain way. And if you don't have someone like yourself to first understand what is their program, dissect what works, what doesn't work, and then say, okay, these are your priorities. You might want to consider that. And when you remove that, then yeah, you're right. I've never thought of it that way because we're always thinking about being accountable. Mm-hmm. And if let's say many of us have issues with, let's say, with our health, and so I need to be accountable to work and work out more. But if it's not in line with my priorities and I'm saying yes to this and no to that, so that's a really great way to look at things. My last question I want to ask, and it goes back to your childhood with your mom. It's so interesting because I don't know if you see this, but it's like you were an only child and you're all about community. Mm-hmm. And your mom was about prioritizing her career and you're like prioritizing my family. So though your mom and dad love you, obviously, as you mentioned, but she taught you something very important at age 12. Now you have your own kids. So you help your clients, as you shared very, very articulately. What do you hope your daughter learns from you? Or is there a story that you can share about your daughter that it's so fascinating? You go, you know, your mom priority work, and now your priority is your kids. But any stories you can share about your daughter that you hope that she learns or that she already has learned thanks to your self-awareness and your ability to let her be her own butterfly?
Yeah. I like the way you said that. I would say this. So the thing that I focused on with my kids, perhaps because of the journey I described to you, is really not trying to put any shoulds on them. And it's been interesting to be home during 2020, during this pandemic, and have this time with my 12-year-old and my 17-year-old that I value so, so, so much. And an illustration of what the result of not trying to put shoulds, and by the way, I'm not perfect, right? Like, I'm a mom, I'm a human, shoulds come out sometimes, but you know, really here she is, she's a junior in high school. She's on the cusp of, you know, going to college. And we've had all this time together over the past 8 months or so to talk about what the future is going to look like, which I know we wouldn't have gotten, but for the fact that we've had this weird world event. And we've spent a lot of time walking in our neighborhood just as something to do. And we've got great nature and we try and get out and enjoy it. And we've had such good conversations. And I've seen her evolve from, well, I should go to the quote unquote best school I can get into, and I should have this kind of career, to having more of a conversation around, what do I want my life to look like? What's important to me? And recognizing that that can change as my seasons change, but starting now, what's important to me? Do I want to leave home and have that typical college experience? Do I want to be able to work and go to school at the same time? What is it that really drives me? And so she's made the shift from all of these shoulds to, oh, you know, I was the voice of Alexa for my school and I took this digital media class and I loved it. And so maybe I want to look at how I can match that up with my love of sports. She's played basketball and soccer since fourth grade. And so how, you know, I'm probably not going to play in college, but how can I bring my love of sports to this media and marketing stuff? And what do I do with that? And what are the options? And what could that look like? And she's even started her own, albeit small, digital media editing business during this pandemic, because she's been free to kind of chase those various options and look beyond the edges of, you know, we've even talked about, could you have a job someday where you only work 6 months a year?
Oh, absolutely. You can have a job.
And that you absolutely can. Yeah, I think you can too. But just being open to the possibilities, as opposed to, this is how I did it, or this is how Nana did it, or this is how someone else did it, right? You're going to do it the way that you're going to do it. And that's okay. And let's talk about what you need to get out of it.
You know, Becky, what's so inspiring about your story to kind of end this episode up is that you grow up with a mother and a father that loves you. You have the sense of self-awareness. And now here you are as your own mother. But the fact is that your daughter is already 17. So she's already a young woman. But as you train and coach and mentor her, she will be a better person. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, she'll be a better girlfriend and husband and mother and in a community contributor in the world. So like this whole butterfly effect of community, it's just so interesting that as you're sharing your story, I'm like piecing these things together. I'm like, oh, this is so cool. But the reason why you're so inspiring as both a mother, a leader, former lawyer, and executive coach, because you see all these various elements, but at the end of the day, people need to be inspired. if they're not talking about happiness recipes or butterflies, it's frankly really boring. It's not just about goals.
Yes.
It's about inspiration. So thank you so much for inspiring me and our audience. Becky, thank you so much and have a great day. Thank you for listening to the Gifters Podcast. If you want to learn how to turn your story into a successful speaking and online coaching business, go to christopherkai.com to learn more.